Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When basic rules of supply and demand just don't hold. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us this Monday, December 22nd. Crude oil prices, again in the news today. Want to guess what they did? Yep, they fell. And key members of OPEC made it clear over the weekend they intend to keep on drilling and pumping. But why would a maker of really anything flood the market with excess supply? We asked Scott Tong from our sustainability desk to find out.
Saudi Arabia is OPEC's biggest and most influential member. Yesterday, its oil minister said the cartel would never cut production. Bhushan Bari at IHS Energy says OPEC's last supply cut in 2008 backfired. Competitors ate into its market, and cartel members don't want a rerun.
Brazil, Russia, the United States would take over their customers. Prices could fall to 40 to 30 to 20.
Let's say prices fall to 20. That could benefit OPEC long term by cultivating a new generation of drivers, says Amy Myers Jaffe at UC Davis.
If you're a country like a Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, where oil is your main export, you need to act and make sure that oil prices are not too high and that you're able to sustain continued demand for your fuel.
Low prices mean a war of attrition for oil sellers. The Saudis drill it cheap and they have a fat wallet. Not so for their nemesis, Iran. Valerie Mercil of the Chatham House think tank in London says the Saudis would prefer a bankrupt Iran to one that's flush.
Should Iran start to withhold some of its support of the Assad regime because of having to tighten the belt with lower oil prices, that'll be seen as a victory. Should Iran go forward with its nuclear program, that'll be seen as a major failure in Riyadh.
If low prices indeed yield the intended pain, perhaps Saudi and OPEC's key members will pump forever. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Those low gas prices, we're seeing them here at home. Gas prices in the U.S. have declined for 88 consecutive days, according to the AAA. That's the longest period of falling prices on record. Now, we did a whole show on how crude oil goes through the economy, from your gas tank to the food you eat, even to that ruby red lipstick you wear. You can check out the show. It's a good one. It's online at marketplace.org. Now it's time for you procrastinators. If you want your gift under the tree in time, you gotta get going. Some stores will still let you order as late as midnight Eastern time tomorrow. Then it's all up to the shipping companies to get those presents there on time. To keep up with seasonal demand, FedEx has added 50,000 workers, UPS 90,000. And both companies have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on capital improvements. But with so many of us doing our shopping at the last minute, you gotta wonder if it's all enough. Sally Herships has more.
Last Christmas was rough for UPS and FedEx.
What they had to do is they had to turn away packages.
Jarrett Streben is CEO of EasyPost that makes shipping management software. He says the big carriers have spent a lot of money getting up to speed for this holiday season, and they've done well. But long term, they may need to do a lot more. Amazon's new service in New York, Prime Now, offers deliveries in just 1 hour. John Callen is managing director of Ursa Major Associates, a shipping consultant. He says Amazon is disrupting the delivery business by cutting big shippers out of the equation.
So Amazon is even now dealing directly with the Postal Service. So it's a huge threat.
Callen says one way to deal with this disruption is for carriers to get flexible. They may even want to be like Uber and crowdsource to find drivers to deliver packages.
Well, because it gives you flexibility, of course.
Amazon didn't respond to a request for comment, but what if the company decided to become a carrier itself? Satish Jindal is president of ShipMatrix. It also makes shipping management software. He says that could happen, but not in the short term. There are huge obstacles, including finding the right management, and if delivery drones don't work out, then dealing with human workers.
Amazon needs to be cautious. Those people could be a great target for the unions and Teamsters, and that would be not good news.
Right now, Amazon is able to contract with the cheapest carriers out there. But all of these changes to the shipping industry mean a likely happy ending for consumers. More competition means better service and lower prices. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Markets today seemed like traders were in a festive mood. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In the season of big ticket movies, The Hobbit, Annie, Night at the Museum. But the movie business, it's just not doing great right now. The weekend is the fifth one in a row that lagged behind last year. And ticket sales for the whole year are down 5%. On top of all that, you've got The Interview. Sony pulled the movie, but said over the weekend that it would be released, even if it doesn't know exactly where or how. We check in with Grantland's Wesley Morris when we want to talk movies. Wesley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So it sounds like Sony wants to get The Interview out somehow. What choices does it have?
An enema, maybe? I mean, they have many options at their disposal. You know, what put them in this corner in the first place was not simply caving. It was the fact that they literally had no place to release the movie. And so now they're promising to release the movie. They just don't have a venue to do that yet.
Will they find one? Do you think somebody will say yes, or they'll put it on Crackle, I guess?
I mean, it would be quite sad if Sony suddenly just couldn't innovate a way to distribute this movie. Odds seem very high that video on demand or some streaming platform will be the primary way to see this movie.
Right.
And so the sort of audience response to the release of that movie is going to be interesting.
The Interview aside, if you're a movie theater, how do you get people to come back to the theater?
I don't know. I mean, haven't they kind of tried everything? I mean, Hollywood is, I mean, they've allegedly changed the quality of projection, but that's a crapshoot from theater to theater. So I don't know if you're a theater what exactly you do. I mean, you can't put anything else in the popcorn to make it good. I mean, 3D was a thing for a minute. These like large scale spectacles were presumed to be a real draw. And for a moment they were. But I think the movie industry got really dependent on them, and I think we're reaching a plateau period.
Is there a movie that you are really excited to go see this holiday season?
No. I mean, this time of year, it's astonishing the way the studios, all of them, I mean, the smaller ones and the larger ones, I've been calling it Dumpcember, basically, because you've got maybe 30 movies just dropped into the end of the year to qualify for awards.
Right.
I wish that they would take this cluster of December movies and just space them out. But I think, yeah, obviously the fear is that if you won an award at the end of the year, you have to assume that voters have no attention span and can only respond to an avalanche of movies.
Wesley Morris is a film critic at Grantland. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As the holiday shopping season nears its end, retailers are doing anything, everything to lure us into their stores and onto their websites. My email box this morning was filled with breathless last-minute offers, up to 75% off, free same-day shipping. It was a little exhausting just reading all those exclamation points. But those sales have got to work, right? Or they wouldn't do it. Marketplace's David Weinberg checks out the value of a sale.
I'm standing atop the Eiffel Tower. Okay, not the real Eiffel Tower, a sort of replica of the Eiffel Tower. It's about 10 stories high, and it's at the center of a place called the Americana. It's an outdoor shopping mall in Glendale, California. Down below me, next to a fountain, are three drummers playing along to hip-hop versions of Christmas songs. The art of retail spectacle is not new. When I was growing up, I sometimes went to a mall that had a giant fake mountain in the center. Security guards dressed like mountain rangers. Retailers go to great lengths to attract shoppers. And when that doesn't work, there's always the sale.
It's the great big holiday wish sale this week at Toys R Us.
So how do sales work, psychologically speaking? Take a car, for example.
Imagine that a new car is $30,000 discounted to $20,000.
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke.
So you say to yourself, oh my goodness, this is really worth $30,000, just right now it's $20,000. So it gives you an extra sense of value.
And because sales are temporary, they create a sense of urgency.
It's a short-time thing, then you better take advantage of this.
But do sales actually get people to spend more, or are they used to lure people in so that store gets its slice of a zero-sum pie?
So this is not just specifically towards the holidays, but we've been finding over time that more than half of all shoppers are right now saying that they want to spend no more than they had in the past. Now, that puts a pretty firm ceiling on what they're willing to spend.
Amy Koo is an analyst with Kantar. She says sales are a good way to get people in the door, but what's really important is that they come back again after the sale is over.
We've been seeing over the last 5 years that while people may be spending the same, they're actually concentrating their spending on fewer stores, which makes a big difference in terms of making sure that you as a retailer try to secure the loyalty of the shopper.
Stores do that by offering programs that give deeper discounts to loyal customers. There's also the low price guarantee. Walmart, for example, has the Savings Catcher program. Shoppers scan their receipt, and if they find the same product cheaper at a competitor, Walmart issues a gift card for the difference, ensuring a return visit by that customer. A few blocks away from the fake Eiffel Tower in Glendale, I met LeJean Smith waiting to cross the street. He had a shopping bag in his hand, and I asked him if he'd been lured into the store by a sale, and if he thought the sale got him to spend more than he normally would have.
Yes, on both answers. Yes, spend more money, and yes, to get me through that door. And it works every time.
And with that, the light changed to green, and he headed across the street. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up?
After hours, when it's just me and the mannequins in there, it is an incredibly magical experience.
The joy of playing the largest musical instrument in the world inside a department store. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average leapt 154 points, nearly 0.9%, to close at 17,959. The Nasdaq rose 16 points, 0.3%, to end the day at 4781. The S&P advanced 7 points, 0.3%, to finish at 2078. Healthcare stocks suffered today. Gilead bombed 14% after its hepatitis treatment, costing more than $1,000 a pill, was passed over by the nation's largest manager of drug benefits, Express Scripts. Express rushed up 1.75%. Energy companies slumped, reflecting the general concern about low oil prices. Chevron shed 0.8%. ExxonMobil moved down 0.3%. And Tesco Corporation, the Houston-based drilling firm, bore down 5%. Bond prices rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.16%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rosdahl, in case you didn't know who this was.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending and durable goods orders for November. Maybe you're getting an appliance for Christmas. It also releases the final estimate for third quarter gross domestic product. And Pearl Jam frontman Eddie Vedder turns 50. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrian Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Pharmaceuticals can be incredibly expensive, and insurers and lawmakers are pushing back. Today, as I mentioned in the numbers, we have news that the U.S.'s largest pharmaceutical benefits company, Express Scripts, is dumping one expensive hepatitis C drug in favor of another that it was able to get at a cheaper price. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports on what deals like this might mean for the cost of your health care.
The drug maker Gilead was the rock star of the biotech community. Its hepatitis C drug cured 95% of patients in only 12 weeks.
This drug launch has been the massive drug of the year.
Michael Cherney is a drug industry analyst with Evercore ISI. Despite the positive results, he says Gilead's pricing, around $84,000 for a 12-week course of therapy, was a hard pill for customers to swallow, which is why Express Scripts dropped Gilead in favor of a new drug from rival company AbbVie. The cost of AbbVie's drug is almost the same as Gilead's, but Charney says the behind-the-scenes discounts likely drove the cost down even farther.
History will tell you that it's about a 20% discount. Could it be potentially higher? Maybe.
Cherney says biotech drugs like these often cost billions of dollars to develop. Dr. Robert Fontana is a professor of hepatology at the University of Michigan. He says having multiple drugs to choose from is a good thing, but exclusive arrangements like the ones Express Scripts brokered with AbbVie are not always best for the patient.
We don't want to have our hands tied to be told we can only offer drug A or drug B, because there may be a reason that the one that's not offered may be preferable for the patient in front of you.
Fontana says there are still too few biotech drugs on the market to be truly cost competitive. The next step will be to wait and see how other prescription benefit managers like CVS behave and whether they'll seek out exclusionary arrangements similar to Express Scripts. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
All right, my friends, we are headed into the bathroom for this next story, urinal territory. Ask anybody about urinals and you're likely opening the conversational floodgates, because whether you love them or are a little bit disgusted, chances are you've got an opinion about them. And that brings us to today's installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer... By brain work and blatant.
Mike Dolan listens to our show in Alameda, California, and he asked us this.
So I've always wondered, why do you never see a urinal in a private home? I have a friend who has 4 boys, that's 5 males in a house, and they're constantly flushing toilets and wasting all that water, and it's like, why don't you just get a urinal?
Good question, Mike. We sent Gigi Duban to the men's room for an answer.
Homes with urinals are really hard to find. I asked around and started getting weird little tips, which brought me to this house.
My name is Grace Troncalli. Right now we're in Al's breakfast nook and butler pantry.
Al is Troncalli's late brother. She inherited his house.
Look at this bathroom. Is this the most gorgeous thing you've ever seen?
There is a urinal in here. And let's just say Troncalli and a man she once dated appreciated it.
I'd be on the bathroom pee-peeing, and he'd be standing right there pee-peeing. It was hilarious, and we were both pee-peeing at the same time. It's fun.
Well, and nobody has to wait for the bathroom to be freed up.
Right.
For couples, the discussion about whether to put a urinal in the house usually goes something like this.
Would you like a urinal in your bathroom?
Yes.
You said yes?
Yes.
I've always thought about having one in the bathroom because it does use less water. And it's like jet, you know, and it's gone.
Okay. So, what does the wife say?
No.
Marcy Jones manages the showroom at GLS Plumbing Supply in Birmingham. She says she sold a few.
Not often, but occasionally. It would be for the man cave in the basement where the man's going to be all the time, and this is something he's always wanted in his home, and the wife says, okay, fine, we'll do it downstairs.
I asked her why they're so uncommon.
Because most women do not want urinals in their master bath.
But even though they haven't caught on in homes, urinals, in one form or another, have been around for centuries. The French even made them sound elegant. Andrew Howe teaches history at La Sierra University.
the first pissoirs, as they were called, which were actually just barrels, believe it or not, were instituted under Napoleon III in the 1840s. This was part of his attempt to sort of clean up Paris.
Fast forward about 25 years. The United States, right after the Civil War, Howe says there was a huge population explosion and workers took to the factories. Dumping urine by hand into rivers and behind bushes was impractical and gross. So Howe says in 1866, a guy named Andrew Rankin patented today's urinal, which connected to a sewage system.
A lot of these factories and business owners put in bathrooms, and the urinal was much more space-saving than a sit-down toilet. So particularly as much of the workforce was male, urinals made a lot of sense.
But wives were usually the ones making decisions about the home. And why would they choose to have a urinal? Since it can't replace a toilet, it was a luxury item. A luxury item many women still don't like.
I think it's ugly. I think it's absolutely ugly.
Now, remember our question asker, Mike Dolan, and that buddy he mentioned with four boys? Well, Michelle Marsden in Berryville, Virginia, is their mother. She says there's no way she'd put a urinal in the house.
I asked Mike if he ever cleans toilets or if he's ever cleaned a urinal.
The answer was no. But let's get to the big question. Does a urinal save money? We go to John Kohler. He's an engineer who studies the water efficiency of toilets and other fixtures.
The savings was not that much in terms of dollars on your water bill.
Kohler says it's true, urinals do use less water. But he says the savings with a urinal would be less than $40 a year. So your best bet?
I would say get a dual flush toilet.
It saves money, it saves water, and guys, it'll save you grief from the ladies. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
And if you've got a question about bathrooms or anything else, we've got a place where you can ask it at marketplace.org. About a month into the Christmas music season, where stores, doctors' offices, everywhere it can seem like, pipe in pop covers of Deck the Halls and Muzak versions of Silent Night. But not at the Macy's in Philadelphia. There, customers are serenaded by the largest musical instrument in the world. It's called the Wanamaker Pipe Organ. And for the past 25 years, the Wanamaker's thousands of keys, buttons, and controls have been played by one guy.
I'm Peter Richard Conti, and I'm the Grand Court Organist at the Wanamaker Organ in Macy's, Center City, Philadelphia. The Wanamaker Organ is certainly unique, the way it's situated in the middle of this, I call it the Cathedral of Commerce, if you will. I mean, it's an amazing space, 150-foot atrium ceiling with this incredible organ on one wall that speaks into all the departments. I'm just above women's shoes, and my console actually is in women's casual wear. After hours, when it's just me and the mannequins in there, it is an incredibly magical experience to hear that instrument singing in that kind of cathedral environment. The Wanamaker Organ has a fascinating history. It started life as the 1904 St. Louis Exposition organ, built by the Los Angeles Art Organ Company. And John Wanamaker, the Philadelphia merchant, wanted an instrument in his new department store. And so he found this instrument and purchased it and hauled it to Philadelphia in 13 freight cars. And there's a wonderful picture inside the organ of these 13 freight cars with John Wanamaker, Philadelphia, emblazoned on the side of the cars. Once it was set up here, Wanamaker decided it wasn't big enough for his space, so he hired 40 full-time men to triple the organ in size, literally. It went from 10,000 pipes to where it is now almost 30,000 pipes, the largest fully functional playable musical instrument in the world. I first learned to play the organ. My mom tells a story when I was very young. I used to use the edge of the piano as a teething ring. I'm not sure that's true, but it's a charming story anyway. But my mom was a pianist, so we used to play duets on the piano, and then later we got an organ in my house. And I remember a family trip across country in a station wagon, four children and two adults. The only thing I remember about that trip was stopping at the Mormon Tabernacle when I was, I think, 6 years old. And I remember seeing that magnificent organ case and hearing that organ from a distance. And I pulled my dad's shirt. I said, "Dad, I want to go play that." And that was the first time I really was hooked. It takes a lot of dedication and commitment and patience because it's a difficult instrument to play. There's so many things going on. It's multitasking at the nth degree, basically. I literally, for a 5-minute piece of music, I will spend up to 20 hours preparing it on an instrument. The Wanamaker organ is played all year long, of course, but at Christmas time especially, we get thousands and thousands of people into the store, into Macy's, to hear this instrument. And it actually accompanies the very famous light show, thousands and thousands and thousands of LED lights. And it ends up with this incredible finale when all the lights in the tree comes on and the organ plays a really wonderful arrangement of O Tannenbaum. It's a thrill because you get to have these huge audiences every couple of hours, you know, in the store. I love what I do.
This was part of our series, Disappearing Jobs. You can listen to more at
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
One final note before we finish up today. Pope Francis gave his annual Christmas address to the priests, bishops, and cardinals that run the Catholic Church. And no, it wasn't all warm and fuzzy. Instead, the Pope chastised them for workplace ills. Everything from working without coordinating to office gossip to jealousy to pandering to the bosses. I think there's something maybe a little comforting in this list, and knowing that these things happen pretty much everywhere. All right, that's Marketplace for this Monday. Today, the Dow leapt 154 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq rose 16 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 advanced 7 points, 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.